Pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it. Today's conversation is a companion to the new fall edition of the Quail Forever Journal, which includes an awesome photo essay imagined by Quail Forever editor Orion Sparks, who will be serving as my co-host for this episode of On the Wing podcast. We're joined by two of the very talented photographers that made up that photo essay, Brian Grossenbacher, and our very own Aaron Blackschmidt are those two talented photographers. We'll start with Brian as our guest. It's very nice seeing you again, even if it's through a video screen. We were reminiscing before I hit record. I met you for the first time maybe about 10 years ago in Staples, Minnesota on a grouse hunt with Orvis, but I was no stranger to your name. You've got to be the most well-known upland photographer in the country. At least that's me putting a lofty title on you. But let's start with who you are, where you're from, and give us a little background on how you got into photography, Brian.
Bob, thank you. Thanks for the kind words. Brian Grossenbacher, and you know, I got into photography a little bit by accident. I was asked to write a book on fly fishing Montana. And when they gave me the photo budget for the book, at that time, I didn't even own a camera. And my plan was to buy photos for the book. And when they gave us the photo budget, it was $1,700 or $1,800. And it certainly was not enough to buy photos. And so I decided, man, I'll go out, I'll buy a camera and two lenses and see what photos I can get for myself. And just started shooting. I was a fly fishing guide at the time. And
what year was this?
This was in 2005.
Okay.
And I started guiding in 1992. so way back when. And actually, the year "River Runs Through It" came out, it was a good and a bad time to be a fly fishing guide. Getting back to the book, you know, the photo budget was so light that I bought a camera and a couple of lenses. And started taking photos and very much self-taught. And by the time the book was published, I had literally fallen in love with photography. And started to get some positive feedback from fishing magazines, and was starting to do some photo work for Orvis. And I kind of thought, man, this is something that I really want to pursue. So for the next 5 years, I started guiding less and taking photos more. And upland hunting has always been a love of mine. And I just transitioned from fly fishing into bird hunting as well. And a lot of similarities in many respects. And a lot of overlap with people and friends, and so that part of the sport came naturally. But I often say, and I pinch myself that I'm one of the luckiest guys on the planet to have transitioned from guiding to photography, and it has allowed me to see some of the most amazing places on our planet.
Yeah, that's interesting. I had no idea that you weren't a classically trained photographer. And I also equate you with Orvis, I mean, you've done so much work for Orvis and Reed Bryant. It feels like that both of your stars kind of rose together. Because correct me if I'm wrong, most of the photography in Reed's book is your photography, right?
That's correct. He and I met actually in 2010, and we met on a fishing trip. We were heading over to the Pinoy River in Russia to fish for Atlantic salmon, and Reed was doing all of the work on the for the Pinoy River Company, all of their media. He was doing all of their literature, and I was going to go over and capture the photography for them. Huh. We actually met in Helsinki. And there is a funny story. Before I met Reed, the morning of, he locked himself out of his hotel room in only a manner that Reed can do. But long story short, in Helsinki at a very nice hotel, he steps out of his hotel room for whatever reason in his underwear, and the door closes behind him, and he decides he's got to go down to the front desk to get another key. And again, only in a way that Reed can do, he hits the wrong floor and he goes below the lobby, a floor below, which is this underground shopping mall. And he steps out of the elevator, closes behind him, and he's in the shopping mall on a Sunday morning or Saturday morning before it opens. And you can't get back to the hotel from the shopping mall. And so he's now in his underwear in the shopping mall. Fortunately, it was closed, but all of the stores are closed with those grates, you know, yeah, over the front of them, and the doors are locked. And so Reed, he finds his way out of the hotel eventually, or out of the shopping mall, makes his way back up into the lobby where now we have all gathered. You know, there's 10 or 12 of us going to the Pinoy River Company, and we're gathered with our suitcases. And Reed walks in the front door of the hotel in Helsinki in his underpants, you know, and it was the best introduction, and we've been friends ever since.
Well, I will ask Reed if I could get a photo of that incident as the graphic for this particular podcast episode.
I don't have a photo, do you? No. I may have some more damning photos from over the years, but maybe or maybe not appropriate for your audience.
Oh, Reed, we love you. That's a great story, Brian. If I missed it, tell me again where you're from originally, Brian.
You know, I was born in Pennsylvania, but moved all over. You know, lived in Indiana, Texas, Iowa. Went to college, undergraduate in Indiana at a small school called Wabash College. And as soon as I graduated, I headed out west to Bozeman, and went to graduate school at Montana State. And like many people, decided to stay. Lived in Bozeman for 35 years. Have two daughters that still live there. Actually, one daughter that is expecting. My oldest daughter, Mackenzie, is expecting here in the next couple of days, which means that I will be a grandfather, which is a word that I'm having a hard time pronouncing. It's just not rolling off my tongue.
Grandpa Grossenbacher.
Yeah, man, Gigi. Congrats.
Thank you. Thanks, man. So Bozeman for 35 years, and about a year and a half ago, I moved down to southern Utah, and have been down here since, and I'm just loving it.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you very much for joining us for this conversation and for contributing to the Quail Forever Journal. You're Your talents precede you, so it's wonderful to have you on the podcast, Brian.
Man, that is that is so kind, and Ryan, thank you for the idea of this photo essay, and I was talking with Bob before. It's when I had a chance to review it, like I just started, you know, turning the pages, and it's and was looking at each and every photograph, and as I told Bob, I loved everyone else's way more than mine, you know, and I was inspired and envious at the same time, and it was you guys really did a nice job with it.
Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah, you bet.
We'll get to the story behind the idea in a moment. Before we go there, we'll reintroduce a gentleman to our podcast audience. It's been a minute since Aaron Blackschmidt has been on the podcast. Our listeners know him for his videography talents, which are extreme. He is the creative genius behind Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever films. The last, what are you, 4 years, 5 years, Aaron? 4 years. You know, kind of under the radar, he supplies his photography skills as well. And just like Brian, you came to photography in untraditional manner. Maybe for our listeners, remind folks where you're from, Aaron, and how you got your start with Pheasants Forever.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. It's glad to be back on the podcast. I grew up in Central Washington State, and I was introduced to bird hunting at a pretty young age by my dad. You know, we started with grouse hunting, you know, when we were just out cutting firewood and doing some deer hunting on the side, you know, but mostly looking for birds, I think. That was his whole goal there. We got into chuckers later when I was going through high school, and that was pretty fun. You know, I got my first wild birds, you know, pretty much during those chucker hunts. A little bit of duck hunting as well. But after high school, I kind of got grabbed by the wildland firefighting scene and proceeded to do that for 11 seasons. And it was during that time on the fire crews that I really started getting into photography. And I'd always say, you know, like I wanted to go on a fire just so I could take more pictures, you know. That definitely became the case as time went on. You know, I started when I was a rookie in those first years with just the little, you know, cardboard Instamatic Fuji cameras, you know, you just put in a shirt pocket and they had 36 frames on them. And then, you know, I was there when the digital camera boom started happening. So I got one of those and then actually melted one on a prescribed burn once. And then our division supervisor found it the next season and was like, I think this is Aaron's, and gave it back to me. And I wasn't able to get the film out of it, but that's okay. It's cool that he found it, you know. But I kept getting more and more cameras. And then by my, you know, 10th season, I was packing an SLR on the line and, you know, really trying to tell the story of what we were going through on the fire lines. And so that's when I really started to sink my teeth into it, I'd say. And but, you know, all good things must come to an end. And eventually I decided to, you know, exit the fire scene and actually go to a photography school. So I went to Brooks Institute down in California and graduated with a visual journalism degree, and ended up getting a job with Canoe and Kayak magazine and SUP magazine, and I was their photo editor for about 7 years or so. And during that time, that's when I really got the real world experience on, you know, outdoor photojournalism, you know, going on multiple assignments a year and covering all kinds of cool stuff, you know, not just covering the adventure, but also learning how to shoot environmental portraits really well and all these other little things. And started to do some more video work there near the tail end of that cycle, because eventually a lot of these enthusiast print titles, they all fell by the wayside, you know, which is unfortunate. And props to PF and QF for still making the quality journal product that we do. I think that's pretty cool. And but eventually, so I was freelancing at that point, found myself in Minnesota, and it was in the summer of COVID in 2020 that I got hired with Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. And that was actually pretty cool, because like it was the winter of, you know, that first couple months of COVID, where I saw that they had flown the job for a new video production specialist. So I applied, I didn't hear anything back. Obviously COVID was happening, so the world was upside down. But then that spring, I think it was May or something like that, I was on my Instagram and I saw that Pheasant Bob had liked some of my photos, and I was like, wait a minute, the Pheasants group, what's up with this? So I sent Pheasant Bob a direct message, and I was like, hey, I applied with you guys, you know, a couple months ago, like, what's the deal? And he's like, oh yeah, you need to get in touch with this person, and we'll get you through the process. And, you know, next thing I knew, I was you know, meeting the crew there at the headquarters in White Bear Lake, and they loaded me up with a bunch of camera equipment, and I was heading out to go film Habitat that summer, and then rolled right into the Rooster Road trip, you know, that fall. And that was like pretty much my reintroduction back into upland hunting. And if you've seen the Rooster Road trip, you know, throughout the years, it's definitely a grind, but a really fun one. And so it's been an evolution ever since, and definitely glad to be part of this team here.
Well, so, like I mentioned, you know, the super talented videographer, and if folks have seen any of the films in the last 4 years, you know, it's amazing the storytelling that Aaron puts together, let alone, you know, just the capturing. And I think it's funny, as you tell your story, it's like my worldview of you, Aaron, is like video is like 90%, right? And but your whole background is in photography. What, how do you view yourself? Where is it equal parts? Or do you feel like do you like one more than the other? What's your view of yourself?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, it's about capturing visuals to tell a story. And, you know, the tools change, the format changes, you know, the audience and how you view it changes. Obviously, video takes a lot more gear. It's a little bit more work intensive. But at the same time, you know, I do enjoy both aspects of it. And that is one interesting part about what we do with Pheasants Forever. When we go out and shoot, it's definitely a hybrid approach where I'm capturing video generally as a priority, but I know that we need photos too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I definitely want to make sure that I'm switching over to photo mode to grab those photos whenever I can. And generally they're not the more action driven moments. And I can talk about this more later, but, you know, it's, I try to find those other moments where we are, there's some downtime, and I can focus on the interactions that are happening between the hunters or with their dogs. And so I like switching back and forth. I still love photography, and you know, landscape photography in particular, mm-hmm. nature photography has always been like something that I really gravitate towards. Initially, like right out of high school, when I learned that I was not cut out to be a painter, I was like, well, I think I could do photography. You know, I saw some books, and I was, you know, the whole Ansel Adams, you know, get the tripod set up, you know, you only got 36 frames of slide film in your camera, and you got to make each frame count, you know, and all that stuff. So that was my first, you know, like, I want to try to do this photography mm-hmm. thing. And I still enjoy landscape photography. If you look at my Instagram, that's mostly what I post mm-hmm. is, you know, pictures of the landscape and blurry waterfalls and mountain ranges and sunsets and, you know, all that stuff.
I just find it, you know, it's interesting to be introspective of our own impressions. And I think about my relationship with you and Instagram and how this all came to be. And it was started through photography, but as you applied for a video job, right? So like in my mind, it's like, he's the video guy, you know, but you're so much more multidimensional than that. Curious, Brian, do you do video work as well? Or are you primarily focused on still photography in your role?
I am primarily focused on still photography. The video element of it, it almost to me becomes like algebra. You know, it's you add that extra dimension into it, and I just fall apart. You know, I am cut out strictly for still photography, I just don't know that I could effectively do video justice, and certainly not the way that Aaron does it.
Yeah, well, you're awfully darn good at still photography, so that's a tremendous talent and one that brings you here for us to talk about. Ryan, I'm going to have you set up the concept for the photo essay. Before I do that, I want to thank Onyx, a proud supporter of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, as well as this podcast. And more than anything, a supporter of our wildlife habitat mission and our efforts to increase access. If you go to the link Onyx link in the show notes and click on that link. You'll be taken to a page on the Onyx website where you can get 20% off your subscription. And now is a perfect time as we get into hunting season. You can use 20, you can get 20% off if you use the code PFQF, and Onyx will make a donation back to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission. So thank you very much to Onyx. All right, so the catalyst for this conversation was an idea that you had, Ryan Sparks, the editor of the Quail Forever Journal. Set the stage for us.
Well, I think as so many of us do, we go hunting and we just enjoy our day. And then at the end, taking a photo on a tailgate, maybe with some dead birds and our dogs, is almost an afterthought. Like, oh yeah, we should take a photo to remember this day by. And I just wanted to put together a photo essay that really told the whole story of a quail hunt. And so, you know, we've kind of pulled together a collection of photographers. And I think a cool thing about this group of folks is some of them are like Brian and Aaron, like very established professional photographers. And then we also put out the word on social media, like, hey, or do you have a camera that you carry and you want to like maybe throw your name in the hat? And we actually got some great submissions from that too. So we ended up with a collection of over a dozen photographers, and we really wanted to tell the story of a quail hunt really from start to finish. So while listeners can't really see the photo essay, mm-hmm. which would be a great reason to become a Quail Forever member and get the journal delivered to you, we started off with, you know, it's sort of the start of a hunt. So the dogs are sort of raring to go in their kennels, and we're changing a tire on the side of the road. And then we sort of move into in the field, and there's some scaled quail on the run, and people are smiling and have a good time. And then some dogs are on point. We have some covey flushes, some guns are going off. And then we round out the photo essay with some end of the day photos, you know, a bird in hand, enjoying a cigar, sitting around the campfire and cooking some quail at the end of the day. And it's just really, really great how everybody's individual pieces kind of come together to tell the larger story of what quail hunting is, and also how diverse quail hunting is. Because we have photos in here everywhere from a Florida plantation for bobwhites to scaled quail in the Southwest. So, just our design team did a great job. And it's really, in my opinion, sort of the showpiece of our fall journal.
Brian and Aaron, you both have multiple photos in this photo essay. Maybe just start with Brian. Pick one of them that tells a story to you, maybe beyond what you see, that the listeners would get a kick out of going back when they see this edition of the Quail Forever Journal hit their mailbox.
You know, the one that kind of puts a smile on my face is the shot of the legs sticking out from underneath the pickup truck. That's Ryan O'Shaughnessy's legs that you see in the foreground. And Ryan is, he's a South African. He was a professional rugby player. In my opinion, the most interesting man in the world. I mean, he has experiences. He comes from a multi-generational safari family, and the guy has a story about everything and constantly has a smile on his face. And he is one of the few people that you meet that you can have fun with a flat tire. You know, he like, you know, we were walking back to the truck and he looked up and I'm going to tell you another quick story here right after, but he saw the flat tire and he just was like, what next, man? And he just took a big drink of water and just kind of fueled himself up for this and then just got to work. And of course, like, you know, rugby player, huge hunting background, you know, the guy can hike 15, 20 miles a day. No concerns. And he's handsome. Like he's one of like the best looking guys always like in the room. And with that charismatic smile, the guy has it all. And the flat tire came on the heels of, we were doing a shoot at his place in West Texas, just outside of Alpine. We were shooting a scaled quail. And before we even saw a bird, one of his dogs went on point. And very soon after the point, Ryan realized, oh man, there's something wrong here. And he goes, he started yelling, and we ran down to his dog, and his dog not only had gotten into a porcupine, he had gotten into it and had not let go. Oh. And 15 minutes into a hunt, but it was also the kickoff of a 3-day shoot with Orvis. And so we had the art director there, and we had, many of the hunting models, and there wasn't, pressure outside, it would have probably been more pressure with paying clients, but it was just the fact that there we were 15 minutes into the shoot, and now he has a dog that is, the photos were, truly show the significance of the injuries this dog sustained. I mean, it was, and there was no choice whatsoever. We were miles out in the field, and so Ryan does what he does, or did what he does, and a couple others just held the dog and began pulling the quills out. And I'll send you a few photos of the of the incident, because it was quite a start to the shoot. But kind of circling back to what Aaron said earlier, as a photographer and videographer, but it's not the moments of, the birds getting up and flushing and shooting. Oh, it's not always the action of the hunt that become the centerpiece of the story. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it was very much, two particular sidebar, issues that were actually, some of the most memorable parts of the day, the flat tire and the porcupine, and in no way a reflection on Ryan as an outfitter. He has top notch equipment, but actually, even more credit to him and how he responded to those things, because we just laughed and went along and helped where we could. When I look and I see his legs underneath the truck changing that tire, man, that always just puts a smile on my face.
So, an observation and a question. So, question is, the dog in that story, did the dog come out of it okay?
The dog was great.
Oh, good.
The dog was great, and even in the amount of pain that it was in, kind of behaved very well. It did take two guys to hold it down. It wasn't, but when I say, a mouthful of quills, it was every bit as bad as you see. It was definitely a latch down and not let go situation.
So
tough one to witness.
In the observation, I look at that photo, and you're right. It's you essentially see two pairs of legs, and you could tell that they're underneath the truck. But then you also see the cowboy hat, and instantly, oh, this is probably Texas, and they're reddish orange dirt, and like, yeah, this is probably Texas, and the world's smallest jack in that dirt. I'm thinking, right? You look at that jack and you're like, and there's this random bar underneath Ryan's legs too. And I'm wondering, boy, this could go from bad to worse in a hurry.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And they're both under there. They are under there deep, that a lot of South African experience that went into changing that tire. That was not your typical run of the mill.
There was no even blacktop with an easy propping up a tire and pulling the lug nuts off on this one.
No, and his truck was big, and you know, it's not like getting under the back seat and just pulling out the little jack that comes with the truck either. But yeah, man, he earned that one, and he certainly earned his cold drink at the end of the day. That's for darn sure.
All right, Aaron, like Brian, you've got a number of photos in this essay as well. What's one that jumps out to you, and it tells the story behind it?
Yeah, you know, honestly, like when I'm shooting, like I said earlier, you know, video is always the priority, and you know, I have to be pretty quick when switching over to take those photos. Thankfully, you know, I use mirrorless gear, and it's pretty much just a flip of a switch to flip over to photos. But A, I have to remember to do it, and B, you know, like you got to do it and then take the time to do it right, you know? But you know, generally when any kind of action is happening, I'm typically recording video. You know, any birds flushing shots, that birds are coming back with a dog, that's all on video. So I don't really get those types of photos, which sometimes I'm like, man, that would have been really cool to get that a photo. And people talk about, oh, well, you could take a screen grab or frame grab. Nah, it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. If Brian knows, you know, Brian, we're shooting video at the most 1/120th of a second, you know, sometimes as low as 1/50th of a second. So motion blur is just going to wreck anything that you actually try to take a decent screen grab of. But that being said, you know, I do want to switch over to photos because I know that we need them for the journal and to tell these stories as well. So I tend to look for those quieter moments, you know, whether that's after a bird's already brought back and, you know, the group's around looking at the feathers, that kind of thing. Or, you know, the dogs are sitting there, you know, and I love getting portraits of dogs. Or maybe it's just the group gaggled up and they're looking at their Onyx being like, okay, where the heck are we? You know, like that kind of thing. You know, it's like those little moments that people are laughing or joking at each other. Maybe it's beers on the tailgate after the hunt, you know, like all those little moments. Those are the things I look for when I'm specifically shooting photos. I also, you know, I love landscape images. So this one photo here, it's the, you know, the backcountry in Arizona. And we had, you know, hiked out there with llamas, Bob. It was a fun trip. And we got the camp out there and, you know, like, I think I might have been coming in later. Or I don't know why I saw this photo, but you know, just like stop, take the photo, show these tiny figures in just this huge landscape. Mm-hmm. You know, I always look for those types of photos. But the one that I want to talk about primarily is this one here at the end with the campfire and the stars. And you know, it kind of speaks to some of the separation that photographers have to put themselves through when working with a group. Is, you know, you can't always just be like hanging out with the team, you know, shooting the stuff, and you kind of got to pull yourself back a little bit. And, you know, what's the group doing? You know, after hiking all day, I would have loved just been sitting there in that camp chair, you know, spinning yarns with the rest of you guys. But, you know, I was like, I got to get these photos, you know, and like, I always pack a little carbon fiber tripod pretty much wherever I go. And, you know, thankfully we're beautiful stars out there in that Arizona backcountry. And you're like, well, I'm going to get some night shots, you know? So I'm bouncing around with my camera. And I remember even some of the guys were like, hey, why don't you come like sit down, you know, like you've been hiking all day, like what's the deal? And I'm like, no, I got to get a couple more photos. And, you know, so as photographers to do some successful work, I think sometimes you have to remove yourself from the social dynamic, from the group at some points. But that's oftentimes when you get some of these, you know, more, these better photos. And, you know, sometimes you got to be a little antisocial, but I think at the end of the day, you know, that it pays off in the art you're going to get. In that way. So anytime I see a photo of a group that's off by themselves and I obviously shot it from like 10 feet away, or maybe I was half a mile away, you know, I remember those moments because I was often by myself, you know, shooting that stuff. Same thing, you know, when golden hour happens, I'm not BSing with the crew. I'm out, you know, like, where's that golden light? You know, how am I making that work for me right now? And it's fleeting, but I love it. And I'm always going to get out there and chase that stuff. I mean, Brian, do you experience the same thing when you're shooting with certain groups, that you do have to kind of like remove yourself at times, or kind of, you know, I've been accused of hiding behind my camera before by certain people and I just kind of giggle, you know, I'm like, well, yeah, you know, but I'm working, you know, I'm like trying to get these photos. And do you experience that at all in your own work?
Absolutely. And as you were talking, that resonates perfectly with with me, and in fact, like, I will purposefully try to disappear, and especially if I'm shooting someone new that is somewhat nervous in front of the camera, if I can disappear, and sometimes it takes shooting with a long lens as the shoot is starting, so that I can remove myself even farther from the group and just pull back so that people forget about me and concentrate on the hunt. And that's when I notice that I start to get, you know, the truly athletic moments, the graceful moments of hunting. And so absolutely, Aaron, disappearing and hiding behind the camera and oftentimes on purpose, just so that I can remove myself from that situation and let the moments happen.
That's totally right. And it makes me think too, that there's a flip side to that coin too. Like when you are working with someone that's maybe new around a camera, I often, you know, will engage with them more socially sometimes too. I will just hold the camera off to the side, kind of above my shoulder, especially if I'm doing a portrait shoot and you're sitting there talking to the person. So they're looking at you, not necessarily remembering that you have a camera in your hand and you're actually maybe clicking some frames, you know, and just like talking to them, getting their story, and then moving the camera up, grabbing a couple of me, like, oh, that's really cool, you know, and like creating that dialogue. And I think there's also something to be said about, you know, bringing these people in along on the process with you, you know, especially when I'm shooting a documentary type film. You know, I want buy-in from the people that I'm working with. I want them to be excited about the work that we're collaborating on this project, mm-hmm. whether it's a documentary film, it could be a portrait shoot, or we're going out on an upland hunt. You know, I want them to be excited about, you know, the photos that we're going to be creating together, right? Because it is a partnership at the end of the day. And so I think there is a balancing act that photographers and videographers kind of always have to walk. And I can generally tell too, when I'm looking at someone else's work, and I'm looking at your work here, Brian, you obviously are comfortable around your subjects. They're comfortable around you. You know, the smiles that you're getting, like with the lady with the shotgun here, you know, and she's just got this huge magnetic smile. She wouldn't have probably done that as easily had you not already built that rapport with her. And I think that that's something that photography is more about. It's more than just the equipment that you're using. You know, like you could go out there with a nifty 50 lens and get amazing photos. You don't necessarily need the fanciest camera, the fastest this or that. It's about the relationships that you build with these people. So when you do step away, you feel like you're allowed to do so. You've already built that rapport and you're able to do that. And so when people go out with their cameras, don't feel that, you know, the technology is holding you back or anything like that. Make those relationships, talk shop, talk story when you feel you need to. But when you need to bump away down the line and get a shot of them walking down the trail or like spreading out into the field, you don't have to feel awkward about it. You've already kind of built that relationship.
Right.
You go ahead, Brian. Those are really wise words, Aaron.
The shot you referenced, or it was a photo of Rebecca Jones, and that look on her face is pure joy. And if you could bottle that up, she had just shot her first scaled quail. And it may have been her first quail, period. In fact, I think it was. And I had been following her and was shooting with an 85 millimeter fixed lens and just on a gamble. I mean, that is not a lens that I would carry in the field. I mean, that's a portrait lens and it's fixed. And so I was finding myself, you know, and there are I think three or four other hunters around, and I just was going to stick to the gamble, and it was like Rebecca was my subject matter, and I was going to stay by her, and because it was a fixed lens, I had to, you know, I kind of had to stay close, and it was probably a 40-minute, you know, walk, and I started thinking, man, I'm spending a lot of time here. And all of a sudden, like, it happened like that, you know, the birds got up and she shot the bird, and the when the bird fell, she was so excited, you know, and that look on her face says it all. And, you know, a little bit later, she was so happy, you know, shed a tear as she and actually Ryan O'Shaughnessy on that as well. They were, you know, taking a look at her first bird. It was a very emotional and very happy and special moment for her. And I was so happy and privileged to be in that position to, you know, to capture that. And that was truly a special one. And she's a wonderful person.
Hmm. That's a great, so you were kind of headed down the road of tips and tricks, which is awesome because you guys are sharing some wisdom here. I'm going to take us there to a bit of a lightning round and ask you each to share kind of tips and tricks for the upland photographer. Before I go there, you talk about fantastic moments, and I want to recognize Greenbelt Premium as our sponsor of Premium Moments in the Field. As of this podcast, you can now buy first ever Pheasants Forever labeled Greenbelt Premium and Premium Light. It is on sale in liquor stores in Minnesota and the surrounding states, six states around Minnesota, available now. And today's premium moment comes from Instagram, from CT the Iowa Uplander on Instagram writes this, and it's selected specifically for our Quail Forever audience. One unforgettable premium moment I had happened in November 2022 when I went down to Kansas for the second time ever to chase bobwhites, and I brought along my Vishla Maggie. Until this time, she had only been on a couple of puppy runs and never been out on a real wild bird hunt. At the time, Maggie, the Vishla, was 4.5 months old. It was running 40 yards in front of me when she went on a rock solid point and swung 90 degrees to her left. And like a statue, she was pointing a single bobwhite quail that flushed as I approached. I dropped that first pointed quail for her. And that was a memory that will live on forever as we head into our third hunting season here. I cannot wait, but that was the story of our first ever pointed bobwhite quail. So thank you to CT, the Iowa Uplander, for sending in that premium moment brought to you by Greenbelt Premium. We've got a prize pack on its way to you, and thank you for participating. And thank you to Greenbelt Premium, the pheasant-friendly beer. All right, you guys, we're starting to go down the road of tips and tricks for the upland photographer. And as Ryan and I were preparing for this episode, we talked about, you know, one thing that people probably, or a couple things that people probably don't think about when they're photographing the uplands is a lot of times you're behind the hunter. So like that image that you caught, Brian, of the joy, a lot of times you don't get that opportunity because you just see the back of somebody's head. Or when you're hunting rough grouse, you're walking through the jungle of tangle and you can't see the hunter, the dogs, the birds very well. So, you know, and the while our birds are beautiful, pheasants and quail and grouse, when they're alive, when they've sat in the back of a vest for a little while, they don't look as beautiful. So maybe take us through, we'll start with Brian, maybe throw out, we'll go around the robin, round robin, on tips for folks to take better upland-oriented photos. We'll start with you, Brian.
Man, that's a good question. The, you know, sort of the street photographer's adage, you know, is F8 and be there, you know, and it's kind of a simple phrase, But, you know, you've one, the hardest thing to do is to set down your gun and pick up the camera, mm-hmm. you know, and for me, and it's the same in fishing. I've been to some of the most amazing places in the world, hunting and fishing, and I just can't pick up a gun or a fly rod, because next thing you know, it'll be day three of the shoot and I've done nothing but fish, you know? And so, I truly have been to some amazing places and never touched a fly rod and never touched a fishing rod, never picked up a gun. So I would say step one is that is dedicate yourself to walking along with a friend, your hunting partner, and leave the gun in the truck. Because you will find that your focus shifts. You start looking for different things. You start you're not watching the dog as much for birds, but you're seeing the movements of the dog. You're seeing the landscape. You will see, I think, in some ways, a broader version of the situation that is presented, whereas your goal is no longer to shoot or harvest a bird, but to capture the scene, and so you're able to loosen your focus, and in some ways you could argue that it you know, you may see some things that you would not have seen, and in some ways that can help your hunting, but set down the gun, pick up a camera, and don't be afraid to, you know, to shoot what you see. And you know, sometimes you know, what you see through the lens doesn't, you know, it doesn't translate, but that's, for me, that is how I started to see what I like through the lens. And for me, it was very, experiential in that, and that's the beauty of digital photography, is that you can come back and look and see what you've captured and see how you would improve that for the next time. But very simple step one is set down the gun, have the discipline to set down the gun, and to take it a step farther, to really get the good stuff, like, you kind of have to set down the gun when you know the hunting is going to be good. And you know, like, and that's, you know, that's kind of where the rubber meets the road, man. You know, it's like easy, you know, in the midday sun, you know, and the hunting hasn't been that great, it's like, oh, okay, I'll take a few shots. Well, guess what? You're going to get a few shots of absolute junk. You know, you've got to be able to set down the gun when the light is right and it's prime time, you know, and you know that the birds are going to be there and the dogs are fresh. And it's tough to do, but that is the logical first step.
I don't know, Ryan, I think I'm out. what about you? Cause you, Ryan, you try to do both. Right, you try to be a photographer, a writer, and a hunter. What do you think? Could you put the shotgun down and just focus on a camera?
Unfortunately, I think Brian is. That's very good advice. You know, I've found that when I try to do both, my photography and my hunting or fishing suffer. And it's like you kind of lose out. You think you're going to split the difference, and you end up kind of losing out on both. I can remember one trip in particular, actually in Ecuador, fishing for some really high elevation trout. And it was the first time that I knew the fishing was going to be really good. And but I didn't even take my fly rod out of the truck. I just grabbed the camera stuff and came away with that day being like, man, I just enjoyed the day so much more, focusing on one thing rather than trying to, and if you think fishing and taking photographs is hard, like upland bird hunting and taking photographs, I think is probably the hardest thing to split, because you, a lot of times you don't know when the action's going to come. And it seems like when you want to have the camera in your hand, you've got the shotgun. And when you have the shotgun in your hand, you have the camera. It's like the birds know. So yeah, that's a great piece of advice.
It is a good tip. And I'm thinking about our buddy, Aaron Blackschmidt, the entire time Brian is telling that story, because in all the years we've worked together, I've only been able to convince Aaron to put the camera down and carry a shotgun one single walk. Not even a hunt, one walk, Aaron. You were nodding your head on during that entire tip, weren't you?
Yeah, and to kind of piggyback on Brian's comment there about putting down the gun and picking up the camera, you know, it's he's totally right. You know, just give in to the photography, like become a student of photography. And ostensibly that means, yeah, like look at what other people do and you know, read a book, watch a YouTube video or something like that. But the next step, what I think a lot of people miss, is really invest in the post-processing. You know, get a good computer, get some software that runs on that computer. I use Adobe Lightroom. I love it. It's like my go-to for organizing, cataloging, editing, exporting, all of that in like one-stop shop. There's other softwares out there too, but what that really does is then you're able to analyze your own work and get excited about going out the next time, because you're always going to be improving. I had a professor that said you're only as good as your next photo, right? But that was his trying to instill a work ethic in us. But at the same time, learn from your mistakes. You're not going to make those mistakes unless you get out there and really just shoot a lot. I think the other thing people do too is they will take out a camera, but they're hesitant to just bang on that shutter. You know, like I shoot a lot of photos. I overshoot according to some people, right? But at the same time, I don't mind. You know, it gives me plenty of stuff to work with later, and I'm still learning about, you know, what's working, what's not working. Like I'm a big fan of motion blurs, and if you've ever done those, you know, you have to shoot a lot of photos to get maybe that one really cool shot of, you know, the person's in focus but everything else is blurred around them. You know, you see this with like Olympic shooting a lot, where they do the motion blurs. But you can do that out in the uplands too. There's lots of different ways you can get creative, but, you know, really elevate your game, you know, invest in yourself. And it's one thing to shoot, but you don't want to just leave those photos on the memory card. Get them onto the computer, edit your work harshly and critically. Sometimes it pays to have a friend or a mentor or someone help you with that process, because they're going to identify things that you did right, things that you could improve on, et cetera, et cetera.
The photograph you talked about in the essay, that campfire scene, and I'm curious about what pops to me is the clarity of the stars with the motion of the fire and kind of the sort of the lights on the horizon. Did you use a particular technique to capture clarity of the stars and have when you talked about motion blur, it got me thinking there's something going on here that I wouldn't be able to capture to my own devices.
Yeah, I think, you know, in that particular shot, you have to hold the camera steady. And by hold, I mean mount that sucker on a tripod. And, you know, I think in that particular shot, I was just using the self timer. You know, you can set the self timer for 5 seconds and you can get it to fire off like 9 shots in a row. And that shot right there, I'd have to look, but it was probably around like a 20 second exposure, give or take. ISO probably in the 2000 range, give or take. And have your lens wide open. And by that, I mean f2.8, f4, anything, you know, tighter than that, and you're going to start to lose light being able to enter into the camera. So that's just experimentation too. You know, I like shooting night shots. I am by no means an astrophotographer. I like sleep way too much to really get into that. But, you know, when people are around, you know, just play around, you know, use that tripod. You can use the same technique for shooting moving traffic, waterfalls, you know, anything that could have some kind of motion in it, seascapes, and you can play around with those shutter speeds. You know, anything below generally 1/60th of a second, I think, is the general rule, where you really got to start worrying about camera shake. And your photo could be sharp and, or sorry, in focus and sharp, but you're wiggling the camera too much in your hands, and you're gonna get a blurry image, right? But that can also be a creative technique, and I use that there in that photo.
So let me ask, most of our conversation is focused on traditional cameras, high-end equipment that, you know, both of you guys carry around for your jobs. But think about other folks like Ryan and I that maybe just have the camera that's in our pocket. Give us a tip or a suggestion to take a better photo than the end of the tailgate, matted up dead birds, that doesn't really portray hunters always in a great light and doesn't capture the beauty of the experience or the hard work of the dog. Like, what, any things that occur to you that could make a person like me a better photographer?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great question, Bob. With an iPhone, and I want to qualify this as I'm a terrible photographer with my iPhone, but the one thing you can do that is so easy is think outside of the box, change your perspective. Everyone is taking their photo from here, you know, right in front, you know, at head level. Drop that phone to the ground, man. You know, put some cactus in the foreground, you know, and you can tilt your phone so that you can see what is going on. But, you know, if you're in the desert, you know, you've got cactus in the foreground that's telling the story. And then, you know, get in front of your hunter, anticipate the path that they're walking, and shoot it with some landscape in the foreground. On the iPhone, go to that 0.5 setting and go super wide angle. Tell the story of the landscape of where you are. It's a lot easier than your buddy Bob, you know, sitting on the tailgate with a bunch of dead birds, you know, sitting in front of them. Change your perspective. Shoot from the waist. If you don't want to take the time to bend over, lay on the ground, you know, shoot from the waist. You know, use your environment to frame the photos. You know, oftentimes, you know, Bob and your home woods, you know, it's so thick and challenging to get a good photograph because the trees are so tight, you know, those 1 to 3 inch new growth saplings are just maddening. But even with your phone, you can get some cool stuff of framing the hunter as they're passing through these gaps in the trees. And you can do that with your phone. You can capture that, and you can get, you know, multiple frame exposures, you know, so that you're not just trying to get the one shot. But change your perspective, utilize, incorporate the environment, and then frame your subject with the environment. You know, try to separate and put emphasis on the story that you're trying to tell.
I think that's terrific advice. I think about, you know, the height of a dog and getting to the eye level of a dog and shooting eye level of a dog, capturing, there's so much in a bird dog's eyes, and you can't get that from 6 foot, or in my case, 5'6". So you got to get on your knees, and that changing the angle makes tremendous amount of sense. What about you, Aaron? What do you think, whipping out that iPhone or that Droid, any suggestions to help improve our photography as upland bird hunters?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, just what Brian's talking about with some of the stuff he's talking about is great advice. You know, anytime you can add depth or context to your image, you know, by getting low and putting some out of focus stuff in the foreground. And these compositional techniques, they work just as well for SLRs, you know, even better, I'd say, in some cases. But, like, you know, mess around with that perspective. Hold the phone over your head and they kind of simulate a drone look, or climb up on top of the truck and get something really high that shows people walking through the habitat. Or, you know, like running up the slope, if there is a slope, you know, to get kind of that drone-esque look, right? Or dropping it down super low. So those are all great techniques. But first, though, if you have your phone in your pocket right now and you're listening to this, take it out, open up the settings, and make sure that you're shooting raw. you're going to be able to do have a lot more creative post-processing leeway with a raw photo than a JPEG, especially on these super tiny sensors that are in our camera phones. The second thing I'd recommend is turn on the grid lines. This will put like a tic-tac-toe grid superimposed on your screen. And that's just going to help with composition, let you utilize the rule of thirds compositional techniques, leading lines, putting your subjects in certain spots in the frame. That's just going to, you're going to naturally flow towards those if you do have those grid lines set up. Another thing I'd recommend too, most phones can do this because they have a hard time figuring out the optimal exposure of a shot. And anytime you're shooting in mixed lighting or golden hour or anything like that, you can actually manually change the exposure on your phone by simply just tapping on the screen and then tapping and holding and then dragging up and down. And that'll change the lightness or the darkness, overexposure, underexposure of the image. That also locks your focus in place too. So then you can move your finger back over to the shutter button and then click, right? So these are just some simple like technical things that you can do with your phone that will, in my mind, you know, vastly increase the quality of these images. Past that, the one thing I always, I mean, like I try to drill into my head, and I would encourage everyone else to do, super simple. When you pull that phone out of your pocket, the first move should be to wipe the lenses on your t-shirt, because these lenses, they get so smudged in your pocket. You reach in, you grab them, you put your icky thumbprint on that lens, and then you go to shoot a photo and you're like, why is this thing blurry or look like crud? Especially if you're shooting into any sort of light source like the sun or headlights or anything like that. So be just kind of try to get into that habit of cleaning those lenses just with the tail of your t-shirt or whatever, right? To get yourself the best optical quality that you can get out of your phone. And I said this before too, but shoot a lot. You know, mess around, shoot a photo, move over to the right, shoot another photo, get low, shoot another photo. And then, you know, look through these photos later when you have some downtime, you know, pick through them, put a star or a heart on the ones that you really like, and then just delete the rest. You know, like we have this ability, and don't feel that you're limited by how many photos you can shoot. You know, shoot a lot, delete the bad stuff, and move on, right?
Those are great suggestions, especially the technical ones. I'm gonna listen back with my phone in front of me, because I don't know that I have a buy. Well, I know the grids, I don't have that turned on, and I mean, I'm aware of the rule of thirds, and you know, the eye follows the Z, you know, and things like that. And but yeah, that'd be a great hack that I haven't ever added to my phone. So. Thank you.
And you can experiment with it, you know, like you might think, oh, well, this is just too distracting, or I already know where to put my subjects or whatever. But, you know, if you're wanting just something to try out and see if this might help your photography, then give it a shot, you know. The cool thing about the grid lines, too, is I think a lot of people, regardless of how high or low they hold the camera, they're putting the horizon line right in the center of the frame. And I would encourage people to place that horizon line in the upper third or the lower third. You know, either give weight to the sky or the landscape. And just that little simple thing right there are going to make your photos maybe that much better, you know?
And the other one, the smudge is a good one. And also, if you're hunting with lots of layers in cold weather, always have your lens facing out, because otherwise your lens is going to pick up the body heat and it will be fog, you know, fog up instantly when you hold it up in cold weather. I know that by firsthand experience when I wanted to take photos and I'd got to wait 5 minutes for my lens to defog. All right, those were excellent. Let's go to closing final thought. Ryan, I'm going to let you get in on this one too. All right, you guys. So Ryan, you're going to kick us off. You can go you can photograph a hunt. Got to leave the shotgun back. You can go anywhere for any bird with anyone. What's the trip you're going to take with the camera? Sparks, you can kick us off.
I mean, you didn't specify living or dead. So, I think I'm going to go Aldo Leopold on the family farm with my grandparents and my dad. And I mean, I'd probably be picking their brains as much as I would be shooting with the camera, but, yeah, I think that would be a cool trip.
There's a curveball.
Bob White's.
I wasn't expecting to be hunting with people that aren't with us anymore, but that's cool. Aaron, you get to go second.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, so I recently moved back out to Washington State last summer, and I guess one of the things that I'm looking forward to is just kind of reintroducing myself to the local bird hunting opportunities out here in the Pacific Northwest, because it's been a minute since I've been, you know, traipsing these hills, and things have changed. You know, we've had a lot of wildfire activity that has slicked off a ton of habitat. I saw that on a hunt last fall where Kitty Willis drove up from Oregon, and she's like, dang, Aaron, why'd you bring me up here? There's no birds, there's no habitat. And I'm like, I'm sorry, Katie, you know, like, we'll go somewhere else next time, you know. But I've met a fair amount of people now that live around the area, you know, might have to go out to Idaho, you know, Southeast Washington, or just over to Douglas County, you know. But there are spots, and I kind of want to figure out where those spots are. And, you know, I don't have bird dogs. I'm definitely not an avid upland hunter. You know, I'm definitely a photographer. So, you know, if anyone's got some ideas, they want to come out and meet me, whatever, you know, like, just hit me up. I'm pretty easy to find. So that's kind of what I'm looking forward to. And obviously I'd like to get out with my father a little bit more too.
Yeah, right on. Well, you got beautiful landscape out there, so I'm anxious to see when you do get out after some birds and some new habitat, what it looks like. Brian, you can get the final thoughts on this episode.
10 years ago, I did a hunt with Reed Bryant and Dan Michaels, owner of Crystal Creek Lodge in Alaska, and we did a ptarmigan hunt. Mm. And we landed, took off, and landed in one of his restored beavers. And Dan was basically just looking for likely spots and where there would be birds and where we could land the plane. And we landed with, you know, those big Alaskan tundra tires, and as soon as we were unpacking the gear, we could hear ptarmigan, you know, mm. in the background. And we spent probably 4 hours of just running, laughing, shooting. It was without a doubt, hands down, the best wild bird experience that I have ever been around. And it wasn't gluttonous, it wasn't in excess, but it was a combination of excellent dog work and plentiful birds. But it was the thought afterwards that we are the only people in the world that are enjoying this hunt right now, and you know, in this location, and you can say that about anywhere that you are in life, but this one was special. You know, it was just so remote. And as we wrapped up that hunt, you know, we kind of took a post lunch nap near the plane, and we're all of us, and between the three of us have been fortunate to see some really special things in our lives, and you could tell, and I'm speaking for myself, but you could tell that it was running through our head that, man, this one was truly great. Mm. And if I could go back and do anything again tomorrow, I would do that hunt again.
I remember that story, in what I remember, the orangeness of the tundra in your photography. That one, was that in Gray's Sporting Journal? Is that?
I think so. The Orvis used some of the shots, and then Gray's did a photo essay, and I know that Reed has written about it as well. But it was that late September light in Alaska is truly special, and it adds a dimension to the experience as well.
Well, I think the greatest praise that an upland hunter can give a photographer is that I went with you on that story, and it made me want to go there for real, because that's the top of my bucket list, is to go on a hunt in Alaska for ptarmigan with my own dogs and experience that September orange tundra. And I remember that story, the photography from that story. So kudos to you and kudos to Aaron. I did go with you on the llama hunt in the campfire, and we did experience some beautiful places together, and that shows up in the photography in this essay. So Ryan, well done conceptualizing this concept. Fellas, thank you very much for passing on some great tips for all of our upland bird hunter audience as we head into hunting season here in September. We hopefully could put it together and see some photos on Instagram that are more than just a bunch of dead birds on a tailgate. Thanks to the three of you fellas. Appreciate it. All right. For Brian Grossenbacher, Aaron Blackschmidt, and Ryan Sparks, I'm Bob St. Pierre reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. And get out your phone and take a good photo, because we want to see it. Thanks for listening, everybody.